Welcome to G.L. Horton's Stage Page. Today is Sunday, the 3rd of December, 2006. We have two monologues for you today. In between, we have part two of the interview G.L. gave at OSU regarding her play Boston's Brothers in Liberty. This part discusses both practical frontier feminism and the use of old music in this historical play. But let's start with Walter Graham reading a short piece exploring one side of the global warming controversy.
Some idiot politician goes on television and says, "Pay no attention to Al Gore. Global warming is not science. Leftists want to ruin our economy and take away our God-given freedoms. But God is still up there." Totally crazy, right? Wrong. What this jerk is saying is correct, but who would suspect that when it's being said by an obvious wacko? That's what these right-wing ranters and Fox News people are all about. They're the bad guys that we're being conditioned to disbelieve. Global warming isn't a hoax. The cause and cure, according to Gore, that's the hoax. Our planet goes through 36-year cycles of warming, many ice ages and sizzling drought. The cause is solar magnetic radiation. Greenhouse gas, CO2, doesn't rise. It's heavier than the rest of the air. Fossil fuels are depleting the ozone layer. That's pure BS. On purpose to scare you. For whose benefit? The energy industry. They'll rake in billions from alternative fuel and massive cleanup contracts after they're finished playing the bad guy and bribing morons to be their spokesman. It's all a scam. Stop buying it. Left versus right is politics is pure theater. There's only one ruling party, the Money Party, with two wholly owned subsidiaries.
Thank you, Walter. I hope you all noticed the link added to the cover art. And now, part two of GL's interview at OSU.
When you reconfigured the script from like the junk files on your computer, was it pretty much the same, do you think, or did a lot of things change?
Well, there were parts of it I couldn't read at all, but there was enough there for me to remember the arc and the character. So I was able to make up new dialogue to fill in the blank. And then I did some changing of structure. Like all my plays, it was too wordy, and I threw out where everybody said too much. And put in a couple more scenes where they said less and more interesting things.
Okay.
But if you were to ask me which ones are the rewrites, by now I've forgotten.
Okay. But there were some.
But I do have some files back on my computer, so I could look it up if somebody were suing me or something. You know, I could tell what my first draft looked like and what my second, third draft looked like.
Okay. I guess one of the.
Well, I guess not my first draft. My first draft the second time around. Because my real first draft is much of it just gone.
Okay. All right. Along the lines of the feminism that you're talking about, Dr. Woods brought this up in class with Mary and Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
That feminism probably wasn't around in the 1770s. So.
Well, now, you may think not, but actually, that, unlike American history, that's what my graduate degree is in. And I have read extensively about women in that period. Well, not as much as somebody who has a PhD in it.
Right.
But I have, it's a lifelong interest. I was interested in feminists when I was in grade school, when I didn't know that there were any left. You know, those were those crazy ladies in the 1700s and 1800s who didn't understand that really the way we live in America now in 1950 is the way you're supposed to live. So I had studied it quite a bit. I don't think I made anybody say anything that they wouldn't have said or do anything that they wouldn't have done. Their reasons for doing what they do would be usually differently based than modern reasons. I mean, we tend to give secular reasons, while they tended to base things in spiritual or biblical reason. All souls are equal before God.
Right.
And you owe your first duty is to your conscience, and your second duty is to your husband and children. So people did make these points. Not everybody thought that way. And American women have, from the get-go, been much freer than women elsewhere. We were notorious, even in the 1600s, because there weren't as many of them. You know, women are a surplus in most populations. If your wife dies, you can get another one easily. But American women, we were an immigrant country, and it's the men who came over. And there weren't enough women to go around. So you could sell yourself at a high price.
Okay,
so you had much more say. Women were able to divorce. Women were able to work in occupations. Women were able to say no to men that they didn't want to marry. Your family in this country has never been the chief determinant of who you marry. They don't pick you out and say marry that person. And that was a total break from Europe. When Italian immigrants, or now when Muslim immigrants come over here, they still expect that their fathers and the family will choose their spouses. But they just didn't do that. And also, it wasn't a big deal to have a child, to be pregnant, as it was. You know, you were not ruined because you were still valuable. And in some ways, you were more valuable because you were fertile. So pregnant women generally were able to marry either the man who got them pregnant or some other man who wanted them to be an economic unit and wanted to have a fertile woman to be his wife and to give him children.
By Mary not choosing Johnny to marry him, and Sarah kind of talking her out of that.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Right. Never thought about it like that.
Well, I hadn't either until I did the research in it. I thought, you know, that the attitudes that were common in my childhood, which was a woman who has sex outside of marriage and gets pregnant, her life is ruined. But not for our pioneer mothers, that was not necessarily the case.
Reading like the Scarlet Letter, I don't remember too much of it.
Yeah, well, but she did. You know, she had a second chance. You don't realize that because it's all about the guilt. But she was offered, and eventually, I think she does, at the end of the novel, she does.
Yeah.
The Pearl marries into a respectable family. She's not destroyed because she's a bastard.
Forgot about that.
Well, you concentrate on the psychological suffering of people who believe that that sex is sinful, rather than on the actual economic survival of the people who have to live with the consequence of what is considered sin. And they did all right.
I guess the musician and the music in the play,
mm-hmm.
was it actual music from the
yes,
time period?
Yes, that is. I have a wonderful research book. It's called American Hymns from, I guess, 16-something to 1900. So I went through. In some cases, I've used hymn texts from the period that don't match the tune that I picked for them. But the truth is, I don't remember all the tunes I picked for them because, unfortunately, I didn't write them down. But the time I did the draft, I had a tune of the right period for lyrics from the right period for every song in the show.
Oh, wow.
And somebody who's a musical collaborator would be able to find the right tune. And some of the tunes I know.
Okay.
I've sung a choir since I was 9, so I know lots of hymn tunes.
Now, the musician in the play, how there's constant breaks where the musician, you know... The
musician talks to the audience.
Right. What was kind of the point of that?
Well, my favorite playwright is Shakespeare. And when I think of a history play that really makes sense, it's on the Shakespearean model, which was also the model for David Hare writing Stuff Happens about George Bush.
Right.
Now, he doesn't have a narrator, but he has something like a narrator where people, journalists, come out and talk directly to the audience. There's a lot of speeches to the audience. So I feel that, especially for a play about history and ideas, engaging the audience directly is really important. It makes them co-creators of the play. You're thinking about issues that are still, in some sense, alive for you. And the character, to have a character who says this to you and invites you to think about it and react. And it wouldn't upset me if people talked back to me. I've been at wonderful plays, especially plays by black playwrights, where the audience talks back like they do in church, and they either say, no, no, or right on,
yeah.
Preach it.
You know they're engaged and they're actually
something out of it. And I like plays where the lights are up so the audience can see each other as well as the play.
What kind of a venue were you planning, like with this play or
that, I don't. That's why I didn't work on it for years, because I don't have access to production. But it's being sent around. When we had the reading at Playwrights Platform, one of the actresses, the one who played Sarah in the play, was very impressed. She loved the play. And she does have a friend who has a theater that does American history. So I don't know what's going to come of that. But at least, you know, there's this little spark. And I send it off to 2 theaters that do things. And, you know, you don't hear for a year. And even if they like it, it'll be another 2 or 3 years before they make up their minds. So it's a very slow process. But when I went back and looked at the play, I said, gee, this is as interesting as the day I wrote it. And I can probably make it even more interesting if I work on it. And maybe somebody will do it. Well, there's a lot more theatrical activity in Boston than there was when I moved there as a young woman. Then Boston only did plays that come from New York. And that's still what they do mostly.
Right.
But now BU has this wonderful, exciting playwriting program. And the idea that there would be a new play written in Boston and somebody would do it and people would come is no longer totally beyond imagination.
That's good. Making progress then, at least.
The Founding Fathers got feminism? Say it ain't so, man! Apparently that was one of the many things left out of our history and social studies books. If all souls are equal in the eye of God, just how could a religious person justify insisting women be subordinate to man? Perhaps this is yet another example of revisionist theology. Walter Graham again, this time with an environmental piece.
So, Senator Inhofe, you say there's no need to worry about global warming because God is up there? Well, yes, I agree that God is up there, Senator. But what makes you think he's against science? God gave us brains so that we can understand and care for this lovely earth and all the wondrous creatures that live on it. God looks down and sees how we are treating his creation. You think he approves when we dump toxic sludge into his water, pump carbon monoxide into his air, rip down the trees in his rainforest? I think that there are black marks next to your name in God's heavenly book, Senator. One mark for every time you vote in favor of the folks who are smogging up the skies and poisoning the streams. The earth is God's footstool. We are stewards and servants, you and I. Right now, sir, I have to say, you're doing a mighty poor job of keeping the earth clean for God's holy feet.
Thank you, Walter. Well, that's it for another show. Thanks for stopping by. I've been waiting for you to send us feedback or your own recordings. And waiting. And waiting. There's a link on the art right now. Take you right to a page with an email me button prominently displayed. Give us a shout. We'd love to hear from you. Must be off now. Until next week.